Amy Stewart is an author who's written 6 nonfiction books on the pleasures of the natural world, including 4 New York Times bestsellers, The Drunken Botanist, Wicked Bugs, Wicked Plants, and Flower Confidential. Today we'll be speaking with her about her newly released novel, Girl Waits with Gun, which is about 3 sisters who did not fit the mold of the time that they were in, which is 1914. They're in Paterson, New Jersey. It's going to be a fun interview. Amy Stewart, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Wonderful. And you're calling us from Eureka, California. Is that right?
Yes.
Right, nice in Northern California area. I'm from Central California originally, so I'm a little familiar.
Oh, well, I'm from Texas originally, so we switched.
Are you? Where in Texas are you from?
I grew up in Dallas-Fort Worth, and I went to school in Austin at UT.
Oh, wow, wonderful. Yeah, so we did switch. Okay, great. Well, let's get into your book, Girl Waits with Gun. It's a fantastic read. It's a fun read. I had a great time reading the book. It was kind of one of those books that you just sort of zip through. It's really easy to kind of latch on to the narrative. And in fact, I can easily see this book as a movie. It has a very cinematic quality to it. I'm sure that's probably not the first time you've heard that. And the book is really based on a real life incident that happened in 1914. Can you tell us about the premise for the book?
Yeah. What happened is that this takes place in Paterson and Hackensack, New Jersey. These 3 sisters, Constance, Norma, and Florette Kopp, were out driving in their horse and buggy, and a guy ran into them with his automobile and destroyed the buggy. So they got into a dispute over the damages. You know, we didn't have car insurance yet or anything
right.
Cars were barely even on the road. So they got into a fight over damages to the buggy, and it just escalated. And this guy really started tormenting and harassing them until the point where they were getting shots fired at their house and arson attempts and kidnapping threats. I mean, it just kind of got out of control. It was just kind of like they messed with the wrong guy.
So the man, his name is Kaufman, his last name is Kaufman. Mm-hmm. He runs into the buggy of these 3 sisters. In 1914, and one of the sisters, who I would consider one of the main characters, Constance Kopp, she's the kind of woman who doesn't necessarily abide by the mold of women that is set for women of her time. You know, she's given a gun. She actually helps the authorities, and she gets involved in a sting operation. I mean, she's really kind of taking the reins on this.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of my favorite scenes of the book, at one point, I think she's in front of reporters, and she's being prodded by the reporters, like, why are the cop's sisters not married yet? And that kind of thing. She replies, I don't see a man in this room who could stand a chance with any one of us, you know, which is one of my favorite moments of the book. How much of Constance Kopp's, you know, I guess her tenacity or her boldness, how much of that was your creation? How much was actually culled from, like, research based on who she really was?
Well, you know, that's what was so great for me about this story, is that I was able to find out a lot about who they really were and what their personalities were really like. Mm-hmm. These 3 sisters went on to do some extraordinary things with their lives, which will be the subject of future books. I'm going to continue to write about them and continue to tell their true story. But what that means is that I have hundreds of newspaper articles about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have interviews where they are quoted in their own words. So I know specific things they said. I have a letter that Constance wrote. I've interviewed family members.
Right.
So I can't know exactly what they said every minute of every day, but their overall personalities are entirely real.
And as somebody who comes from nonfiction background like yourself, you know, you probably know this more than anyone else. But I know that from my own research also, once you find a story, it titillates you enough to want to research and look into it. But as soon as you sort of hold a document that person he or she wrote, like a letter, for example, in this case, a letter that Constance herself wrote, once you see that handwriting, the curve of the language, the way she speaks in this letter, then suddenly doesn't the person become suddenly real at that point? I mean, don't you get that sense also?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, I've been to their house is no longer standing, but I've been to the place where their house once was. I've been to all these real places where they were. I've been to their graves. And, you know, they're very real people to me. They're kind of, these 3 sisters, I feel about them the way I feel about my own great-great-grandmothers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't quite know them. They're a little too far back in history for me to have known personally, but I feel very attached to them and very connected with them.
Right.
And that's really why I wrote this book, is that by the time I dug up everything I dug up about them, I just thought, well, I can't put this down. I'm not going to I'm not going to let this go. I mean, you know, these three women were completely forgotten about. Nobody knows anything about them today. And I just thought, well, I'm not going to let your story be forgotten. I felt obligated.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Not that there's really any kind of similarity, but just in the subject matter itself, I mean, it reminded me of Julia Alvarez's book, In the Time of Butterflies, where she actually also speaks to about three sisters, you know, and of course, that was entirely different circumstances, but just that kind
right.
of going back to the historical moment and involved with real people and having this, you know, finding this gem of a story within that and being able to, as a novelist, you know, recreate that essence, their essence, you know. And I guess a little bit to further that question, you know, what kind of preparation did you, other than research, did you undergo in order to make the characters believable, specifically Constance? You know, she really is authentic and believable. And, you know, I hear of like method actors out there who go out there and sort of, and I wonder if maybe yours is kind of a method writing, you know, how much of yourself did you immerse into her world and to create that, her character?
Well, you know, one thing I did, the novel is told from Constance's perspective in the first person. Mm-hmm. So it's really her voice. Mm-hmm. And I wanted it to read as if she was sitting in her living room telling you the story.
Yes.
So I wanted it to be in her spoken voice,
yes.
not her written voice.
Absolutely.
And one thing I did is I went and dug up a videotape I have of my great-grandmother speaking to the camera at a family reunion many years ago.
Oh, wow.
And she was from Pennsylvania, moved to Texas when she was very young, but she was from Pennsylvania and born in 1905. So she's as close in age and region of the country to the Kopp sisters as anyone I'll ever know in real life.
Yes.
And she had this very different way of speaking. You know, she spoke in a very clear, almost bell-like voice, very musical voice.
Yeah.
She, women of that era were trained in elocution. They could speak in complete paragraphs. They
right.
And they had this way of holding a room's attention. You know, if they
right.
were speaking, you were expected to be quiet and listen to what she had to say. And so I wanted Constance to have that same sort of commanding voice.
Mm-hmm.
I watched that tape of my great-grandmother over and over again. But I also read a lot of novels of the era. In fact, I've got a Mary Roberts Reinhardt novel from 1912 sitting on my desk right now.
Wow.
And the nice thing about fiction from that time is that they tended to use, you know, odd little words that were popular in the moment and then vanished.
Right.
And they would talk about little details of daily life that
yeah.
haven't survived our popular idea of what life was like 100 years ago. So
right.
I'm constantly pulling out words and phrases and little everyday items from old novels. And
yeah.
I actually have a list.
Oh, yeah?
I have a long, long list of interesting things I found when
well,
I read like
I will
that.
I won't make you run down the list, but was there any one particular word that just kind of leapt out at you? And, because, you know, I mean, obviously I enjoy language myself, and so whenever I come across these gems, it's like those are hard to let go of. Was there one for you?
There's so many, and especially when it comes to fabric and clothes.
Mm.
So there's this word baize, B-A-I-Z-E,
baize.
Which is a type of very ordinary fabric that was used to cover pool tables and for other really practical uses like that.
Nice.
You know, like upholstery and stuff
yeah.
like that. So it's that kind of stuff that just, oh, and Reseda green, R-E-S-E-D-A. That was just a particular shade of green, and
wow.
no one would describe a sweater as being Reseda green.
Right.
Today. We don't even know what that means.
Exactly.
So I love dropping that stuff in.
Yeah, I mean those particulars. I would make it authentic, an authentic read, an authentic time period piece. You know, and I didn't. There was no point in this novel that I was thrown out of it. I was absolutely engulfed in the entire, you know, the whole narrative. One of the things is that I guess this book would fall into the category of historical fiction. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
I know that there are always sort of opposing and debatable definitions of historical fiction, but can you talk to us about, you know, what it means to you in terms of this project?
Yeah, you're right. Everybody draws the line in different ways.
Right.
And what I decided to do is that if something really happened, it stayed in the book. So I tried to stick as close as I could to the real events.
Yeah.
There are a few small things I changed, and I explained what they were in the back of the book. So I was basically just filling in the gaps with fiction, the points in between when I knew what was going on.
Right.
And but I really tried to stick with events of the day. So, for instance, if I'm writing a scene that takes place on November 11th, 1914, I'm looking in the November 11th, 1914 newspapers in Patterson to try to see what was going on. You know, I didn't go to the extreme of always trying to make sure the weather was exactly right. Some people go and look at climate records. Another place where I cut myself a little slack had to do with transportation. If Constance needed to go somewhere, there was a train. In other words, I didn't go back and look at the train tables of the day and go, oh, that train didn't get there till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. She's going to have to sit in the train station. So, and I acknowledged that in the back, some things that I just thought would move it along a little better and that no one would notice.
Right. I was curious. I wanted to ask you that a little later, but actually I'll just ask that now because it seems like a nice segue. You know, that you do include in the back of the book a kind of well-articulated explanation, I would call it, you know, as to where you cross the line of fiction with quote unquote truth. And in the back section, I think it's called Historical and Source Notes or something like that. Why did you, was that something that you felt was important to include, or was that at the publisher's request, or?
No, I did it. And, you know, to tell you the truth, it never occurred to me not to, because there's always something like that in the back of a nonfiction book. So my first six books were all nonfiction. And you always do some explanation of sources and further reading and whatever. So it felt like a very natural thing for me to do. And it didn't occur to me until later that that not everybody does that with historical fiction.
That struck me a little bit odd, too. I mean, I appreciated it, absolutely. But for me, I was thinking, well, you know, I understood that it was a work of fiction, and I felt like I could have gone either way with it. But I really, the story was so compelling, and it was so believable to me that I frankly, personally, didn't care. You know, it was like, but there are others, you're right, and especially for your own audience base, which is, you know, has always known you as a nonfiction writer, they probably appreciate that.
Sure, and there's also some points in there where I wanted to give credit where credit is due.
I
reprinted newspaper articles about them word for word.
Right.
And those articles are in the public domain because they were published prior to 1923, so the copyright laws are different. So I don't have to attribute them.
Sure.
But I wanted to because they're not my own words. And there are a few places where I will take a set of facts that I maybe got from one particular researcher's, maybe a PhD, a dissertation that I read somewhere that had some interesting little detail about the Patterson silk strikes or some issue of the day. And I wanted to give credit to the person whose ideas those were. So part of it was that as well, just wanting to acknowledge that historical fiction doesn't come out of nowhere. A lot of other people work to unearth some of this stuff.
It's probably helpful, you know, at least probably when you're facing Q&As, I would imagine, you know, where I've been in situations myself where, you know, there's someone who is an expert in that time period or on that specific subject in the audience, and they might ask a question, you know, why did you choose this over this? And you already have this kind of built-in response to all of that, I think, with that addendum at the end of the book, which is nice. You know, how was the process for you in terms of, like, how did you make choices between, okay, this really happened, how did you make the choices between what truth did you keep in there and where to fictionalize?
Well, you know, where to fictionalize was really had to do with the limitations of writing in the first person. So because the book is told from Constance's perspective in the first person, nothing can happen that Constance isn't there to see. Or isn't told about or reads about in the paper. So I wanted to explore some other worlds, but I couldn't do it unless I could give Constance a way into that world. So, for instance, this fictional character of Lucy Blake, she's an employee in Henry Kaufman's factory, and she's sort of a beleaguered and put upon factory worker, abused factory worker. Well, the reason she's in there is that I became so fascinated with the history of the Patterson silk strikes. Once I found out that Henry Kaufman, the man who started all this and who was tormenting them, that he owned a silk factory, I thought, well, what is it about silk factory? What is that? And, you know, I looked into Patterson's history and realized that it was a town of silk factories and that there had been this huge strike the year before, and it was an unbelievable story. And I thought, well, how do I tell the story of something that happened a year earlier that only sort of relates to Henry Kaufman? And the answer, of course, was for Constance to literally run into this factory girl and to get caught up in her personal drama, which is all based on real events and very much based on a true story.
In case you're just tuning in right now, we're speaking with novelist Amy Stewart about her fantastic new book, Girl Waits with Gun. I don't know if this happened to you. I would imagine it does, because once you start researching and digging back into history, and for example, you were going over and looking into Paterson, New Jersey, Silk Factory, the history of that. Do you discover that you start finding other stories that are just amazing, would make great books also?
Yes. It's dangerous.
It would
be so easy to get distracted.
That's right.
And to say, oh, I'm going to – never mind about this. I'm going to go write a book about that instead.
Right.
Yeah. I know. The research is so much fun.
And
I have dug up so many interesting, wonderful things, and I try to find ways to work them in. I mean, one of the nice things about the fact that there's going to be many of these books is that I can put the Kopp sisters into situations and explore these little odd worlds.
From coming from having written 6 nonfiction books prior to this one, why did you decide to go fictional with this one and not stay with a nonfiction account of the sisters and what happened?
Well, you know, I thought, first of all, there are all these gaps in the stories.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like I have their diaries or their scrapbooks or a big trunk full of letters. So I don't know what happened for months at a time. So that was a big issue. I also, having written a lot of nonfiction, I know that there is this so what question with nonfiction that novelists don't have to answer in the same way. So, for instance, if I told you that I wrote a nonfiction book about the first woman to fly solo across Canada, you would say, well, so what? Right? Like, why am I going to read that? And I could say, oh, but trust me, this book is so well written and you're going to love her. And it'd be like, I'm not interested in books on female aviators. But if you're reading novels, you don't say that. You don't say, I'm not interested in novels that have to do with airplanes, or I'm not interested in novels about tennis players. You just say, oh, I hear this is a great book. I hear this is a great story.
That's right.
And I wanted to be able to have that kind of fun with it. I wanted it to be a sort of a playful book. I mean, my intention was that it would be lighthearted, if you could say that, about three women fighting a madman.
That's kind of
lightness about it that would make it very entertaining.
Right.
And that's a tricky thing to do in nonfiction, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Was that sort of crossing of genres, going from nonfiction to historical fiction, was that an easy transition for you? Was that difficult?
You know, it's something I've been wanting to do. I mean, I have several failed attempts at novels in drawers, so this was not the first.
Right.
But what was different about this is I thought, you know, I'm not going to let anyone talk me out of this.
Yeah.
I've been talked out of writing a lot of books, and I think this happens to writers all the time. Your editor or your agent sort of goes, what else you got?
Yeah,
and I thought, well, this time the answer is going to be nothing else. I'm doing it whether you like it or not.
No plan B, as they say.
I had no plan B. But the thing that was the most different is that I was not writing in Amy Stewart's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written 6 books in Amy Stewart's voice.
Right.
So picking up the voice of this woman from 100 years ago, and, you know, Constance is a lot more confident and sure of herself than I am, and she's got attitudes and beliefs that I don't have, but there's also a lot of things that she doesn't know. I mean, she lived 100 years ago, so her view of the world is limited in a way that mine isn't. So that's, I think being in her voice is the real challenge for me as a writer.
Whenever I tend to take on work like this, I start to geek out over the characters themselves and the time period, and I start to collect. And, you know, for example, I worked on a book about a woman who was on a Greyhound bus in 1940s, and so I collect this old Greyhound model or a model airplane. Do you start to find yourself collecting things from that time period?
Oh, yes. I have bought many things for the Kopp sisters.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. Well, they have a lot of books.
Right.
I'm married to a rare book dealer, so that part's not hard. But I have a lot of books from the 1910s that I believe they would have owned. They don't have a telephone in this book, but they will in future books. And I have that telephone. I have a stored telephone.
Nice.
It actually works. I'm not talking to you on it right now, but it does
okay,
work.
Okay, good.
Anyway, so yeah, I have gone out and bought things. You'll notice in the book that there's a dairy down the street.
Right.
And there really was a dairy down the street, and I have a milk bottle opener from that dairy.
Oh, that's great.
You know, eBay is a very dangerous place.
It is. I know. I
absolutely like
am with you. I know. I find myself there like at 3 in the morning going, why am I still looking at things?
Exactly.
And you put together just an extensive book tour for this one. I think I was reading it was like something like 23 cities in 30 days, something that was just incredible.
Yeah.
Which I don't hear that too often anymore. You know, what's the reception for the book been like so far?
It's been great. You know, I've always had publishers who do big book tours.
Okay, great.
My nonfiction was all published by Algonquin, and they always sent me on big tours. They're very committed to independent bookstores.
Good.
And Houghton Mifflin Harcourt published this one, and they really did the same thing. They said, you know, you have a lot of friends among independent booksellers around this country, and we're going to go do that. So it was terrific. And, you know, the neat thing is, being on the road that first month or two after the book came out, I already had people coming who were reading it for their book clubs.
Wonderful.
And it was so interesting to get to talk to those groups who had already read the book. For instance, in Seattle, I went to Microsoft. There's a book club at Microsoft.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they had read the book. And so I had, you know, 30 or 40 people in the room who all had these really interesting, specific questions. And it's like, wow, this is the first time I've gotten to talk to this many people who've read it at one time.
That is I love that experience, isn't it? I mean, being able to speak, to talk and have a sort of intimate exchange with your readers. It's phenomenal.
Yes.
It's great.
When you don't have to worry about spoilers. Right?
Right,
Everyone's read it. And
yeah.
They're like, okay, we get it. Now let's get into it.
Yeah,
I love that.
That's right. Absolutely. You know, and that to me is just one of the best parts about ever having a book in the first place is the book club. And then there are so many different ways that people do book clubs. So I would imagine that having a readership of 30 in one group at one time would be fantastic.
It is. Yeah, it's really
and
fun.
And you even created, you had more fun, a little fun with this. And I know your last book, or one of the last books you wrote, The Drunken Botanist,
right,
where you talk about the plants that, you know, are part of the cocktails that we make today and, you know, how we use certain plants for certain drinks.
Uh-huh.
And I know that you created a cocktail that accompanies this book also, right? The New Jersey Automobile?
Yes.
Is that right?
I did. I found out when I did the book tour for Drunken Botanist that if you serve drinks, people totally show up for your event. So I'm like, we're just doing this from now on. I don't care what the book's about. There's going to be a cocktail.
What fun. So what's next for you? You said that you have some other books in line about the Cop Sister still?
That's right. Yeah.
Tell
the next one comes out in September.
What's the title for that?
It's called Lady Cop Makes Trouble. You're the first person I've told that to. It's not a secret. I mean, it is listed on all the all the online booksellers have it listed. But I realized I've never told anyone the title until now. So there you go.
See that? You've heard it here first on Words on
right.
the Wire. So that's great. Wow, wonderful. Well, we look forward to reading that one as well, and we definitely have to have you back on the show to talk about that one and continue this narrative about the Cop Sisters, who are just a wonderful read and great characters. And I said in the beginning, I can really see this as a movie, and I'm sure that that's not the first time you heard that.
Yes, well, I think we're going to have good news to come on that front pretty soon.
Beautiful.
Fingers crossed.
Well, we look forward to it so much.
Right.
Thank you so much, Amy Stewart, for being on our show.
Okay, well, thank you.